Oxford-born, Santa Barbara-raised world traveler Pico Iyer now lives in Japan, so he's been described as a global citizen, or, as he's put it, I fold up myself and carry it around as if it were an overnight bag. He's written 7 books of nonfiction, 2 novels, and is a contributor to publications like Time, Harper's, and the New York Review of Books. Mr. Iyer visited our show this past February to talk about his most recent work, The Man Within My Head, Graham Greene, My Father and Me, which is a vivid, moving account of the great British writer Graham Greene and Mr. Iyer's relationship with his books and life. It was a fascinating conversation, and we are airing it again for you today. I began by noting that the book opens with a scene from Pico Iyer's boyhood at a boarding school, and I asked him, why did you choose that point in your life to start with?
Partly because I was living in California in the 60s, in those days. So I was going back and forth between this Center of Youth Revolution and this school set up in 1440. And I think that formed or deformed me for life in some ways, that commute.
Well, British writers, maybe so many British people, went through the boarding school experience. And do you think that it gave them a different way of dealing with life or a different view of life?
Very much. I mean, it was really a training for empire. And of course, we graduated in the 1970s to realize empire was gone and we were being trained to subdue the natives, but we were the natives. And I think it's no coincidence that so many of the great British travel writers come out of that, because if you're huddling in a cave in Afghanistan, eating stones and conditions of great discomfort, you're basically in boarding school again. It's what you've been trained for life.
Because your life is threatened all the time in boarding school?
Or yes.
Do you feel very lonely, I assume?
Actually, there's almost an excess of people. So there's not always space for loneliness, but we have to run through freezing cold showers at dawn every day, and there was a lot of corporal punishment. Older boys were beating younger boys. It's, I think, half a military, half a monastic kind of training.
More than once, you described sitting down to write this book with the words pouring out of you. Did you feel a stronger urge to write The Man Within My Head than your previous books?
Well, I was interested in that process of almost channeling, where you have nothing you want to write, but suddenly, overpoweringly, something is flowing through you, and you don't feel it's from yourself. It's from some more mysterious place.
But to some degree, there's also like a personal essay, an extended personal essay. Graham Greene triggers something in you.
Yes, and I think, what unsettled me and where the book begins is there I am in the city named for peace, La Paz, Bolivia, and I'm on holiday, and suddenly I sit down and write a short story out of nowhere for an hour, and anyone looking at it would say this is pure Graham Greene. So it makes me wonder, where is he nesting inside my subconscious, and why is he there when I have no obvious connection with him?
But what you'd have in connection with him is that you've traveled all over the world.
Yes.
And you've seen a lot of different political systems at work, and you've seen all sorts of things that that the rest of us might, even as tourists, might not have noticed.
Yes, and I think everybody who travels quickly finds that Graham Greene is the patron saint of the foreigner alone in a confounding hotel room, unable to tell right from wrong or right from left. And so most travelers do feel a kinship with him more than with most people.
When did you first discover Graham Greene?
Probably when I began traveling in my mid to late 20s. Like all too many of us, I had to read him at school, The Power and the Glory, when I was 14, so that made me determined never to read him again. And even worse, my mother was a fan, so that made me doubly determined. So I had in a roundabout way to come back to him in 10 years later.
Now, why The Power and the Glory? That is not a typical Green book, but it is one about the effect of a war on religion, but the Catholic religion. You were going to a British school where there had been an earlier war on the Catholic religion.
No, that's very well said. I think they were just trying to force feed us faith in any form. And just this drunken, dissolute priest who does everything against the rules, who has a mistress, who doesn't perform mass, but in the crunch, he rises to kindness and self-sacrifice beyond himself. They were probably trying to inspire us that even if we were breaking all the rules, it wasn't hopeless.
Now, Greene was a convert to Catholicism, although there are many people who might argue that he was never a good Catholic, and some of his books were banned, weren't they, by the
yes.
Catholic Church?
And he would be the first to say that he was a very bad Catholic. I think at one point the Pope took him aside and said, actually, you're okay. Don't worry about all the cardinals who are banning your books. But you're right, he called himself a Catholic agnostic, a Catholic who didn't believe in God.
And you are you're involved with Tibetan Buddhism?
Yeah, I was born to a Hindu family, went through Anglican schools, live in Japan. I've spent a lot of time with the Dalai Lama. And so probably a little promiscuous, or you could say better, reluctant to fit into any category, which is something I certainly share with Green.
Although Tibetan Buddhism is a lot more permissive.
Yes, that's right.
You've said that you wrote Green a letter in your 20s. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yes, I was sitting in a hotel room in Bhutan, and suddenly the light went off across the city, perhaps across the country. I was in the middle of reading Graham Greene's novel, The Comedians, and so I crouched down and by the two glowing bars of the fire continued reading it, and somehow the book packed such a punch and seemed so to question the traveler's impulse and asked me why was I in this foreign country with which I had no relation, why was I not with my new love back in Japan, was I going to spend my whole life just jumping from hotel to hotel, that I was so moved, especially in that darkness, that I scribbled a six-page letter to Graham Greene because I just wanted to get my feelings out, and he seemed a natural recipient or victim.
And did he respond?
He didn't, but a few...
And you never met him either.
I never met him, but I carried around his address in my address book as a kind of talisman. There's too many people regarded him as a father confessor, and he was tired of that. But a few months later, I did write to him on a Time magazine letterhead, and I asked if he wanted to sit still for a profile. And he wrote a very gracious reply, saying, almost as I'd hoped he would say, no, I'm too busy and I'm nearing the end of my life.
Well, why were you away from your loved one? In a strange place, reading a Graham Greene novel about, he wrote about almost every country he visited. That was Haiti, wasn't it, The Comedians?
Yes, it was, exactly. A good question, and I think I've done a lot less of it since that sort of life-changing experience. But I think I was 31 years old then. I was hungry for diversion. I was always looking for the next adventure. And one thing I love about Greene is that he always challenges the impulses that are strongest in him. So his very wish to take flight becomes the subject of his books, and he always shows how untenable the longing for flight is.
Well, you've spoken about soil home versus soul home.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you explain that?
Yes, that home has less and less to do with a piece of geography, I think, for many people, than with something invisible and portable that you carry wherever you happen to be, whether it's your friendships, your affinities, or your values. And I don't... So I grew up not quite Indian, not quite English, not quite American. But what's more interesting to me is that the kids of the new century are much more international than that, and most of them have one culture associated with their parents, another with their partners, another with where they are, another with their dreams. And home is a work in progress. It's about the collection of those different pieces.
Well, wouldn't Graham Greene be very much a Britishman, a British visitor to other places, even though he wrote The Ugly American?
He was deeply English, but I think the definition of a good Englishman is someone who's always in flight from England. So like the best Englishman, he was always far away from England, and indeed he lived his last 35 years based in France. So he had a vexed relationship with England and with everything, really.
My guest is Pico Iyer, whose latest book is The Man Within My Head. It's published by Knopf. Do you feel at times you suggested earlier that you're actually channeling him?
No, but when I read him, I feel as if I'm reading my own diary. And how does he know so many secrets about me, my most intimate secrets that my friends and family don't know?
Such as? Forgive me for asking about those secrets.
This hunger for foreignness and displacement. My friends may know it in a vague sense, but he knows my emotional patterns. I mentioned at one point in this book that I met somebody fleetingly and then started an email relationship with that person, not relationship, but communication, long emails every day. And it was only because I didn't know the best way to cut it off. I didn't want to continue it, but I didn't know how politely to say no. And I felt that Graham Greene would know exactly that pattern and how to cut through it.
Well, he had many difficulties in his life with the Catholic faith, with women, and especially his struggles with manic depression, which he said prevented him from writing until finally some treatments were developed that allowed him to write. Do you feel a kinship with him in those struggles?
Not at all in that regard. Oh, and I don't really relate to any of his tormentedness or his obscure sense of guilt and fugitiveness. But every writer is a bit of a manic depressive in the sense that you write something in a full state of exuberance and the next day when you're sleepy and look at it, it seems nonsense, and the next day you're exuberant again. And that's almost what comes from sitting alone at a desk hour after hour and watching your moods and having to ride them. So I never fully believed that even Greene was a manic depressive. But insofar as every writer has to go through that remorseless self-scrutiny. I can relate to that.
Well, he wrote at a time when people wrote, people wrote long letters, for example. And you point out that he wrote 2,000 love letters to his wife and then 20 years later to his mistress. That's a lot of letter writing. What did he say in the letters?
2,000 letters in 2 years, so three a day to the young woman he was courting. And they were just torrential bouts of passion, really. Love letters to put anybody to shame. And this is from, of course, a very private, guarded, withdrawn man. And I was delighted when I read those letters because that was the green I had faith in, the secret, fervent, tender green behind the cover of this detached Englishman.
Well, this book is how many pages? 240 or so pages. But you wrote, you say, 300 pages while working on it?
3,000. It's even 3, worse.
3,000,
yes.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
So that's a lot of editing out. What a did lot you cut
of,
out?
A lot of wasted paper. And I began this book as fiction, so I have probably 600 or 700 pages of fictional sketches of imagining Green in places he never was. And then I liked the fact, because I live in Japan, which is the great place of doing without, I liked writing a lot and then seeing how much I could get rid of and still try to have a narrative that held together.
So did this fiction that you have thrown out enrich the nonfiction that you wound up with?
I hope so. I think it became a sort of backstory and a way for me to try to tunnel into this person so as better to be able to write about him nonfictionally.
Well, this is a kind of a hybrid of history, nonfiction, memoir, and you've called it counter-biography.
And you could also call it anti-memoir. And I think because, as I was saying, he never liked to fit within any group or any circle. I was trying to construct a form true to that that's not memoir, not biography, not really nonfiction or fiction either. And it hovers in that sort of dream space that for me is the place that he occupies.
Well, you describe yourself as an outsider, and themes of otherness and displacement are all over your work. Mm. And Green kind of forced himself into that position by spending so much time outside of Britain.
Yes, that was where he felt most comfortable, on the sidelines looking in. And yet all his books, as I was saying, are really attacks on outsiderness and showing the flimsiness or the limitations of always being the detached observer. So I thought that was a tonic thing for me to take on, that not somebody who flatters my prejudices, but really who challenges them.
You've divided this book into three parts: ghosts, gods, and fathers. Were those the themes that you saw in his life and your life?
Mostly in the intersection. It's funny, when I heard you say that, I thought Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. I mean, mm-hmm. There's a trinity going on, and he would appreciate it. And there were three people on the cover of this book: my father, myself, and Graham Greene. But yes, and of course they're almost interchangeable. Where does a god end and a ghost begin? Where does a father you've never met like Graham Greene begin and a ghost end?
Well, you say Greene's books are nearly all haunted by fathers.
Mm.
What was his relationship with his own father?
His father was the headmaster of the school that Green tried to run away from. So a very upstanding, pious, daylight kind of man. And it's interesting, when Green at age 16 tried to run away from his school, his parents, remarkably for 1920s England, sent him to live for 6 months with a wild Jungian dream analyst and a dream analyst's dangerously glamorous wife. So from that moment on, Green almost had parallel fathers. He had the shadow father of this man who was taking him into the realm of dreams, and he had his real father, who was a headmaster. And since I was playing fathers off against one another, that seemed the right kind of pattern or precedent to follow.
You also talk about Green's other self, his dark doppelganger. Do you have a similar other persona?
Maybe Graham Greene speaks for that. But Greene's mother's first cousin was Robert Louis Stevenson, who gave us the ageless parable of Jekyll and Hyde. And I've always loved to write about Emerson and Thoreau and people who write about the affirmation and light and possibility.
Well, you wrote a book about the Dalai Lama.
Exactly, another perfect example. His keyword is probably possibility or potential. So I thought it would be useful to try to look at the other side. There must be a shadow if there's light, and Graham Greene would be the perfect guide into those selves that we really don't even want to acknowledge, but they must be there.
You also write here a lot about fire, which we can't get into, but you lost everything in a fire.
I lost everything in a Californian wildfire. We rebuilt our house on the same property. We were told it'd be safe for 30 years. It would take that long for the brush to grow back. But a few years later, we were encircled by fire, and again and again and again. And I write about it partly because I think it it's a sort of metaphorical thing. For the Buddhists that we were just discussing, all of life is a burning house.
And then rebuilding.
And then rebuilding, but knowing you can't hold on to anything.
The book, The Man Within My Head, is published by Knopp. And thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.